Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here. Hey.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Chaim. And you're listening to the Talk House Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Talk House Podcast. I'm Josh Modell. On this week's episode, we've got a couple of singers who've devoted themselves in slightly different ways to keeping traditional music alive, Shirley Collins and Rady Pete. Now, Collins is 88, and she's had a pretty strange and incredible career. She started performing traditional songs in the mid-1950s, and she notably left England in 1959 to travel the United States with Alan Lomax, recording songs and singers in Appalachia and elsewhere that may otherwise have been lost to history. She recorded some incredibly influential records in the 60s and 70s with Davy Graham and separately with her sister Dolly Collins. And then Shirley left music entirely. It wasn't until the 2000s that unlikely underground musicians would coax her back to performing. British apocalyptic folk industrial band Current 93 were the first, strangely. But it wasn't until 2014, 38 years after her last album, that Collins made a new one. And it was gorgeous and well-received. She's since released a couple more, all for the hip Domino label, fitting for someone who's been so quietly influential. Her latest is Archangel Hill. Check out a little bit of Hairs on the Mountain from that album right here.
Oh, Sally, my dear, it's you I'd be kissing. Oh, Sally, my dear, it's you I'd be kissing. She smiled and replied, you don't know what you're missing.
Now, Rady Pete, singer for Lancome, is one of the many musicians who've been deeply influenced by Collins and by the traditional songs that Collins helped to keep alive. But while Lancome is definitely part of the folk tradition, they modernize the sound in wildly interesting ways. Their fourth and latest album is called False Lancome, and I love this quote about it from Mojo magazine. If modern folk music needs its own OK Computer, its own Dark Side of the Moon, or indeed its own F-sharp, A-sharp infinity, this may well be it. That last album referenced, in case you don't recognize it, is the debut from Godspeed You Black Emperor. If that all sounds intriguing, you'll probably love it. Oh, and the album was recently shortlisted for the prestigious Mercury Prize. Here's a little bit of Go Dig My Grave from False Lancome. Now, Pete describes this conversation as fangirling, though I'm not sure that's entirely fair. There's definitely some mutual admiration happening here. Collins still keeps up with music, and she loves Lancome. They talk about Collins' adventures in America with Alan Lomax, about other singers they admire, and how they share a pretty strong hatred for jazz. Enjoy.
I saw you a few years ago as part of the festival, I guess. Lancome was at St. George's Church in Kemp Town in Brighton.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful evening, and I wanted to come up and say hello afterwards. There's such a crowd around you wanting to talk to you. We thought to just to leave it, and here we are meeting now, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, I wish you had come and said hello, because no matter what the crowd, I think me and all the lads from Lancome would have loved to meet you. Me and Dara are probably your biggest fans, I think. amongst us. I don't know if you've heard, me and Dara have shamelessly ripped off you and Davy Graham. And it's not on an album, but we do. We sing Hairs in the Mountain exactly. Like, we literally tried to copy the guitar part exactly. We loved it so much.
It was fantastic working with Davey, of course. He was a sheer genius.
Yeah, it seems like it. Like, he, kind of crazy ability. And also, it seems like he just changed everything every time. Like, it was different every time.
Yes, that's right.
Was he easy to work with, or was it...
It was most of the time. I mean, when we were recording and practicing, it was easy to work with.
Yeah.
One or two incidents when we had, I think, four or five concerts after we made the album.
Yeah.
And we had one concert in North London, and we met at King's Cross Station. He wouldn't catch the same train as me. He said he couldn't do that. And so it wasn't the best start to the evening, really.
No.
I mean, he would just have strange little moods suddenly.
Yeah.
And obviously all this sort of got worse the older he got. But on the whole, he was really a lovely person, very intelligent. And in those days, you know, there was the accompaniment, the people were playing were really quite dull, quite ordinary.
Yeah.
And as I say, David just came along and started a whole new way of playing.
Yeah, like almost like a new genre within it as well.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, like him and Bert Jansch, I suppose, probably sparked like an entire generation of a different way of playing guitar and stuff. Yeah, no, so it sounds like it musically it gelled always though then. Because I always wondered about that album, The Folk Roots, New Roots. Because it seems like they were kind of, you know, separate ideas or entities that came together perfectly. You know what I mean? Like, but I wondered, did it feel like that to you? Maybe you had the same, maybe you knew exactly what you both wanted from the start. Or maybe there was like a compromise.
Well, I can only ever sing as I sing. I can't sing in the other way. I was just had to sing my songs the way I sing the songs. David just set the accompaniments.
Yeah.
And it was really brilliant to sing against, you know, it sort of energized you.
It's like someone weaving something around you, you know. Yeah, it's very delicate.
And the funny thing is, Rady, I think it was one of the studios or the EMI studio, we were so far apart in a huge room.
Oh, yeah.
He perched on a stool, which is the least easy way of singing, I think. And Davey seemed like miles away at the other end. And yet somehow it just felt, you know, when I listened to it, it felt that we were so close.
Yeah, it sounds like you're just sitting beside each other. But yeah, I know that experience of sometimes it can feel a bit strange when you go into studios to record and they want to put these baffles between you so that the sound doesn't bleed into the microphones. And especially I think for folk musicians, usually you're just kind of used to sitting in a room together, you know, and just like all your practices are just like singing together. I find that strange sometimes. It took me a long time to get used to doing gigs on stages with microphones as well because of that, because everything sounds kind of different.
My least favourite part of doing concerts is the sound check.
Yes, same.
I can't stand it. Hear myself and think, oh God, am I going to run now?
They're like the work part of it, I think. You know, I think travelling to the gig and the sound checks is the work part, and then yes, the actual concert is usually the fun part, for me anyway.
That's right, of course. So, have the most fantastic voice I've ever heard since. Well, I'm sure a lot of people have told you you do remind them a bit of Margaret Berry.
Well, that's a big compliment. I love her singing, yeah. And I have a real kind of soft spot for a lot of the traveller women singing.
Yes.
Because I think I just love the style. And Mary Delaney and Maggie Barry and Rosie Stewart, this kind of, it's just really strong and clear,
it's,
you know.
So direct, isn't it, as well?
It's so direct, exactly. Yeah.
So direct, the singing. I actually saw in London at the Festival Hall, which concert? Which put on, I think, by the English Folk Dance and Song Society. And Margaret was one of the guests, the singers.
Oh, yeah.
And she just took the place by storm. You know, she came, strode on stage with her hair flying, you know, her lovely ropes of black hair, her banjo. And she just stood there and sang and played her banjo in this not very beautiful way. I'd never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful.
Love to have heard her sing in real life, just in a room, you know. Though it feels like it feels like I have, because, you know, when you get to listen to, that's the thing about recordings of people, they still feel really intimate, even if they're like, have been recorded like,
yeah, that's true,
40 years prior. Like, you feel like you know the person. That's why it's quite strange for me to chat to you now in real life, because I feel like I've spent quite a lot of time with you, because I've spent so much time listening to your voice.
Yes. Yeah. You're a straightforward singer as well.
Yeah. I think that's why I might be drawn to your singing also, though, is that it's quite, I like straightforward singing, you know.
Me too.
I think when there's too many embellishments or frills on it, I find it a bit distracting from the story or something, or it distracts me from whatever the emotions in the song are.
A lot of the young singers, especially, they think they have to over decorating songs. We don't decorate much, you know. It's more straightforward than that.
Yeah, I think that might be a shyness as well, though. I think people worry about their voice being good. And I think if you can just get over the fact and not worry about whether it's good, you know what I mean? But it doesn't have to sound nice, you know, then maybe it'll just sound honest.
That applies to you. I think it applies to me.
Yeah, a kind of, direct or honest, I think is a good way of saying it. But I think it's also maybe deciding that, because my feeling on it would be that if a song is really good, it kind of speaks for itself.
Yes.
You don't need to do much to it, really. Like, if you've found a really good song,
sing it straightforwardly.
Yeah, it usually hits the mark the less you try squeeze stuff out of it, or you know what I mean?
You always sung this way.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, when I was about 12, I met a Shano singer who definitely really influenced me. She's the same age as me. We were in the same class in school. Her name's Roisin Chambers. And she sang like proper Shanos, kind of Connemara style Shanos in Irish. And she taught me how to do, you know, the ornaments, the little kind of Shanos, the ornaments. And I just thought she was the most brilliant singer, and I listened to her a lot. That's maybe where I got an interest in folk song from, or like traditional songs. Because honestly, before then, I was just really obsessed with Nina Simone, and I used to sing along with her all the time. But I do think I always sang like this. One of my sisters sings, and she sounds extremely like me. Our voices are very alike, and I think they sound quite like our speaking voices, actually, as well.
Yes.
Because one of the things I always try to do is I do always try singing my own accent, which actually I wanted to ask you about this, because you love Appalachian versions too, and so do I.
Good.
And I always sing them in a Dublin accent and really like confuse everyone. And they always think that they're Irish versions, but I have gotten some of my Appalachian versions actually from you.
Really?
And you're singing them in an English accent.
What?
So you obviously have that same idea of like, you just sing it in your own accent.
You have to, otherwise it sounds like stiche of something. It sounds so false. I sort of fell in love with Appalachian songs and ballads right from the minute I first heard the Kentucky singer Gene Ritchie.
Oh, I'm obsessed.
I fell in love with it. And when I first went to London, I was 18, and I knew I wanted to be a singer, but I had to get a job. I got a job in a bookshop in Hampstead, 32 shillings a week, my salary. And there were two volumes of Cecil Sharp's Dish Folk Songs from the Southern Appalachians, 32 shillings and six. I spent the whole of my first week's wages on the two books, and it was the best money I ever spent in my life, because there's so many versions of the ballads, you know, so different words and names of the he collected from. It was just, I mean, I got into trouble with Ewan McCall because he thought I was just a silly girl, you know, silly about Appalachian ballads. Well,
why?
When you go through, well, why? Because he was mean. So when you go through them, when you go through the book, I mean, the variation in the words and the melodies, just fabulous. And they're so complete, some of them as well.
Some of the language in them is almost more modern as well. Some of them sound like they could be modern, you know what I mean? But they're, I found that easier to connect with, maybe some of the wording in the Appalachian versions, and I love their melodies.
Oh, that's interesting.
I really love the melodies because I also love like old time tunes, you know, like fiddle and banjo playing, because right. I play traditional Irish tunes, which is like, obviously they're related, but there's really different qualities to the tunes, the American tunes, that I find really interesting. And actually with Lancome, again, like people often say to us like, you know, that Irish reel at the end is really great. And it's like, it's not an Irish reel, you know. I think we confuse everybody because there's Scottish songs, there's American songs, there's American tunes, you know, and obviously it's all because of our accents and maybe the way we present it, you know. And then even the instruments, like we use like harmoniums and, you know, like they're not all, I think we get maybe misinterpreted as being Irish, but actually we're very like, because we've been influenced by, that's the thing, like we've been influenced by the likes of Gene Ritchie or mm-hmm. like the likes of, you know, obviously the Watersons, Swan Arcade, you, yeah. Frankie Armstrong, A.L. Lloyd, like all of these people, you know, it's kind of you, as you hear all these recordings, you start building up a kind of your repertoire of songs, you know, and then also the older singers that we hang around with in Ireland and the likes of the Goline singing circle and the Night Before Larry Got Stretched and stuff, and you're just exposed to all of these different versions, you know, that are just kind of being sang and re-sang or whatever. And I think that really the idea of like national borders becomes more and more ridiculous the more you spend time listening to all the different songs, you know, and you realize that there's just the versions just go all over the world.
I spent a year in America and recorded some songs from people in Arkansas, Virginia, sing some of the songs that I noted from them. And we, you know, that's part of the band. We do mostly English songs, most of the music is Morris dance tunes because we have Morris dancers on stage with us. So that we have the same repertoire of you know, the Anglo-American songs and tunes and the purely English tunes. That's what we stick to, because English. We've got a great heritage.
And so these musicians, are they playing tunes that you remember recording in Arkansas?
Yes. In fact, on the latest CD, what's the tune called? A tune that I recorded from two fiddle players in Virginia. They were old men in their 70s, although now that I'm 86, 70 seems quite young. And they played this wonderful tune. We've got that on the album. And I sing a couple of songs from Maida Riddle, the Arkansas singer, as well, because versions were so wonderful. I just felt I had the right to sing them because I'd actually them direct from her as well.
Well, that's it. Like, because I'm actually surprised to hear that you had gotten some American versions from the books that you bought in the bookshop, because I had assumed that you'd kind of come across most of them in that year. So that was, you were traveling around with Alan Lomax.
Yes.
Yeah.
1959.
For a whole year recording people.
No, we were only on the recording trip for 2.5 months.
Yeah.
All the other time was spent preparing for it, trying to get money together to do it. Record companies kept backing out of it. And then finally, the Ertegun brothers said, yes, we'll do it. And they gave Alan $2,000, which was going to last for almost 3 months. And it almost lasted. We got back to New York for about 50 cents. I mean, truly.
Really?
There were no credit cards in those days. So no way of getting money.
That's kind of amazing. It's also amazing to hear that it was hard to get money off people. Like, so obviously no one had any idea how important those recordings were going to be.
No.
It's crazy. So it's only because yous were, like, approaching people and trying to get this money and then putting in all this time that, like, when you think of the amount of material that would have just not been recorded and have potentially died out unless it was handed down directly.
Yes.
You know? Because this is the thing about, you know, let's say for someone my age coming to traditional song and tunes and all this kind of stuff, like all of those field recordings are, if they weren't made, you know what I mean?
They're lost.
You know, like that, and also the recordings made in the 60s and 70s by the likes of you, that is also source material for someone like me, you know what I mean? And it's also part of how you learn about the tradition and different versions, you know, are also these albums that are made. But like, without the field recordings, and the same for some of our Irish collectors here as well, the likes Tom Munley and stuff, like, you know, really there would be songs that would have died out. And I'm not sure, like, now it seems real obvious that, like, obviously this was an important and necessary thing to do, but I don't think anyone really realised how important it was, you know, and maybe it should still be happening.
Well, I'm not sure how many people in countryside, for instance, are still singing songs as they once did.
Yeah.
One editor wrote a book of songs that Vaughan Williams had collected. This is in 1902. He said steamroller commercial music would knock all this out. It would be lost forever. And look, I mean, honestly, how much was lost? I mean, a great deal of stuff was found and recorded. And thank God it was, because
yeah.
imagine how dull life would be without a lot of these songs.
Oh, absolutely. There'd be so many singers and musicians that wouldn't be doing what they're doing now, you know, if they hadn't come across these recordings. And it, like, literally, you know, would change people's lives.
Hey, this is Josh Modell, host of the Talkhouse podcast. We love it when musicians come on the show and talk about process, and often they'll get into the nuts and bolts of being a working artist, which can sometimes be fun and sometimes feel more like a business. Well, this episode of Talkhouse is brought to you by DistroKid, which is an amazing service for musicians looking to get their songs out into the world in an incredibly smart and cost-effective way. For the past decade plus, DistroKid has made it easy to get your music on all the streaming services, including Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Instagram, and more. You keep 100% of your earnings minus a flat yearly fee, which is a better deal than you'll find anywhere else. More than a million artists use DistroKid, and the latest version of their app is better than ever. It includes features that make it easy to see your account details, including the money you've earned, as well as to seamlessly edit things like lyrics and metadata across platforms. There's even a feature called Instant Share, which allows you to easily share files with your bandmates, booking agent, playlist curators, and more. DistroLock allows you to protect your songs. DistroKid users get a YouTube official artist channel, too. The list goes on. The DistroKid app is available on iOS and Android. Go check it out today.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.
Hey, Talkhouse listeners, it's Josh Modell. Instead of encouraging you to listen to podcasts today, I'm here to encourage you to read something great. The particular something I have in mind is the second issue of the Talkhouse Reader, the print zine spearheaded by our fantastic music editor, Annie Fell. This issue is focused on the intersection of food and music, and it features contributions from Maddie Matheson, Coleman Domingo, Squirrel Flower, Sam Evian, The Blessed Madonna, and more. There are pieces about eating while on tour, the gentrification of food, cooking as a creative catalyst, and much, much more. You can order a copy today, along with the first issue, at store.talkhouse.com. Please do check it out.
That it was Alan Lomax who discovered Margaret Barry.
No, this...
Yes, he collected quite a lot in Ireland with Sean O'Boyle.
Okay, and so he heard her singing somewhere just on the street, was it?
Yeah, it was on the street. He could only hear the voice. He walked round the corner, and there she stood with her banjo, and she was singing to the wall so that the voice would bounce off the wall and reverberate through the other streets. And so she'd be able to take her background and get a bit more of a collection. And of course, he was, you know, utterly knocked out and so thrilled.
Because she's got that amazing, she's such a loud voice, and it has to have been from trying to make it travel as far as possible.
Yeah.
Out on the road and against the banjo.
Yes.
That's mad. So she, yeah, he must have been delighted. That's the thing, when you find people like that, you know, and if he hadn't recorded her, you know, like then if everyone else doesn't get to hear that.
Can you imagine life without knowing Margaret Barry, her songs?
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing when I was in America, Rady, that was really lovely is that I knew a lot of English versions of the ballads that they were singing to me.
Yeah.
When I sang them back to them, really surprised that, you know, that I knew them, that the ballads survived in England. And one woman said to me on hearing my accent, she said, "Where are you from, young lady?" I said, "But I'm from England." She said, "What, England over the water?"
Yeah.
So, and many, well, not a great many, but some families had fiddles that they had come over with their forebears as well. And so the music was still being played, gradually changing.
Yeah, and it is interesting how it changed as well. And I find then, you know, if you have, let's say, a version from England or Scotland, you know, and then if you were singing that version to them, sometimes if you put them together, you get more bits of the story, you know, because I find some versions, it's like there must be bits missing because you're like, this doesn't make sense. Like, why did they kill them? Or like, why are they, you know, why do they have to go into exile? Or, you know what I mean? Sometimes there's kind of holes in the plot.
There's some, you're allowed to fill in the gap.
Yeah.
Sometimes the songs with the gaps are more fascinating, as you might know.
I've found when I go and I find out and I fill in the gap, I still prefer the version where you can't tell what's going on. My number one for this was, you know, the song Katie Cruel?
Yes.
And I traced it back about the Licked Bob's Lassie, I think it is. And like basically figured out from the older versions what she had done and why she was so, you know, right, ostracized or whatever. Mm. And it just wasn't as interesting as anything I was imagining when I was hearing the song, you know. I should have left her have her mystique, you know.
Well, yes, there's a good thing to say to that.
Yeah.
Now, Lancum, is it a version of the song Lincoln? Is it named, or is what does Lancum mean to you?
Oh, like Long Lancum.
Is that, that ballad, yeah.
It is from that ballad, but it's the ballad as sang by John O'Reilly.
Right.
Yeah, his version is called Lancum, right. Basically. False Lancum. The title of the song is False Lancum. We might record the song at some point. I think it has about 21 verses.
Well, I wish you would. It's a fabulous ballad. We've got of versions that were collected in Sussex, and I sing one of them.
Is that Lambkin?
It's Cruel Lincoln.
Oh, okay.
He's out to get revenge because he hasn't been paid for the work he's done.
Yeah.
He's a mason and he hasn't been paid. He wants revenge.
It is such a gruesome ballad. Do they murder the baby? And
Yes, and the daughter.
Oh gosh, yeah,
it's wonderful.
In our version, there's bowls of blood. They fill up bowls of blood. Yeah.
But it's you have to sing it as it is. You can't defy that story at all. You know, absolute favourites, and it was sung by a innkeeper not too many miles from where I live.
Oh wow!
And collected by Bob Copper in the 1950s.
Yeah,
and I remember Bob saying that when he collected it, he was thrilled because it was such a rare ballad, you hardly ever heard it.
Yeah.
And then a few days' time, further along the countryside, he recorded another version from another chap and said to him, oh, I've just heard that from Ned Butcher. And his man was furious. He said, no, nobody else sings that. That's my ballad. Yeah. Possession.
Yeah.
So important to some people. I love that because I feel possessive about songs, you know, a lot of them.
Well, also, when you think about it, that's the only way they actually can survive, is generations of people have to feel personally enough about it to learn all of the words and sing it around in public for their lives. And then other people have to hear them doing that to learn after them. So everyone has to kind of really personalize it. And that's, you know, like it has to be like one of your songs that you sing. And it's quite a personal thing collecting, like building your repertoire of songs you want to sing.
I'd love it. One day I must sort of sit down and write a list of all the songs I know. I think it would run into...
It might be a very long list, would it?
It would be a long list, I think. And the lovely thing, right, is I don't forget them. Words. And partly because nowadays if I don't sleep, I just lay in bed singing a song in my head.
Yeah,
I always love doing sort of if you're singing all night long. Thank God I've just got that sort of mind, brain that, you know, I can walk in the kitchen and forget what I've been in there for.
Yeah.
Don't forget the words of song.
I'm over in my parents' house today and they started singing, my mum and my sister were singing a song that I used to sing like maybe 15 years ago, which like might not seem that long ago, but to me, like I have a terrible memory and it feels like a very long time ago. And I was kind of, it was weird because I knew what was coming next, you know, and especially at the moment, I don't sleep very much because I have a young baby. So, you know, like I couldn't even remember the name of the man we got called Lancum off earlier, and it's the name of the band I play in, you know, like that's the kind of memory loss I'm dealing with at the moment. But I could remember all the words. I was just so shocked that it was all still in there, you know. It's a bit like languages as well, though. If you speak another language, you think it's gone, and then when you hear it, it's still all just in there.
What other sort of music do you like?
All kinds, I would say. I'm not getting to listen to much new music at the moment, but I think I've always kind of been a bit obsessed with music. And like, I wouldn't even say it's a genres thing. Like I can like pretty much any genre of music, you know, as long as, I don't know, there has to be maybe something that connects me to it a bit, you know. The only one I find a little bit difficult is jazz sometimes.
Me too. I hate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a divorce of my first marriage.
Oh, jazz did. Yeah. Oh, well, it's a good enough reason.
Seriously. My husband used to go to jazz clubs all the time. In fact, that's where he met David Graham. This is at first when he brought Davy home, and I thought, oh, it's going to be all jazz.
Yeah.
No, he loved jazz, and I hated it. I hated it so much that one day I threw coffee at the wall because I was so angry because he was playing Miles Davis or something, and I just had enough. I had to clean up the mess on the wall.
Oh, brilliant.
No, I love Italian.
So you passionately hate jazz then. That's very interesting, though, because you made an album with Davy Graham, who is definitely jazz adjacent, you know.
I was so wary at first.
Yeah.
Once he starts playing, he knows what he's doing.
He does, yeah. I think he interpreted those melodies. Yeah. You know, he knew what to do. And that's the thing, it's interpreting the melody that's there. Yes. Not.
No, he understood those.
I have a big soft spot for singing, for vocal music, you know, especially harmonies. I really love, that is something I really love. Just, you know, human voices singing together in harmony. I find it really emotional. I really love it.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of maybe one of the simpler forms of music or something. Not that it's simple, but you know what I mean? It's so instantly accessible. There's nothing between you and the person doing it. It's just a human voice.
I don't like choirs.
You don't like choirs, really?
No.
You don't like harmonies singing together?
I like harmonies singing, for instance, an Alabama, when they're, you know, a church meeting.
Oh, you mean the Sacred Harp?
Sacred Harp.
Oh my God, I love that.
Just the most incredible stuff.
That's amazing,
it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it.
Yeah,
we actually spent 4 days at one, 1959.
I'd say that sounded amazing.
Just amazing. Because all the people come from all over the countryside of Alabama join in, so it was a gathering. And they sing with such, you know, trill voices, powerful voices. It's just so full of energy and so full of belief. It gives me goosebumps just to remember it. You know?
Yeah.
Just so fabulous. And I do love listening to that. And also I remember it because I'd come from England, where there was still food rationing, and we had tables and tables and tables of fried chicken and pig pies. And
oh, wow. So it was in 1959, was it?
Yeah.
I wonder if you went back to those same places now, like how many people of those people's children are singing those
songs? I think they probably still are, Rady.
I'd love to think they are.
So in the you know, what you call the congregation, they sat in a great square on four sides with different voices at one, sopranos, and they all got kids on their laps, you know, some got babies in their arms. I think those children would just hopefully have soaked right into them, and they would love doing it as well. It's one of the best sounds ever.
And I love the way they sit like that, facing each other.
Yes.
That it's all into each other. Yeah. I think it's
absolutely right. They all get to choose a hymn as well, to get in the centre to lead it, in their arm up and down. So shrill. As I say, me bumps remembering how fabulous it was.
Yeah.
Surreal.
Yeah, no, that is something I absolutely adore. And one of the other Lancome people, Cormac McDermott, he sings a lot of Sacred Harp.
Does he?
And a lot of his harmonies he comes up with for Lancome is based off kind of that kind of Sacred Harp feel of harmonies, you know.
Fantastic.
I'm not very bad at music theory, to be honest, but there's some note that when you hit it, it just sounds like Sacred Harp, and it's just brilliant. It's amazing, their harmonies. I think I love the way they do harmonies.
There's the white in Kentucky, the other church meetings we went to, white settlers in Kentucky still sing in the style of Scotland, hymns where the lining hymns where leader, the rector or the priest, not that he's a priest, would pull out first line and they'd repeat it.
Oh, okay.
So that they were sort of instructed and then they were allowed to join in. And it was,
oh, like he teaches them the song.
It felt sort of cold. And then you get the Sacred Harp, which is just this great enveloping sound. You just want to live in forever.
I would love to just go travelling around America listening to Sacred Harp singing, to be honest. That sounds like an amazing holiday to me.
You could sing to them.
Oh, I wouldn't. I'd be too nervous to sing to them. They're all amazing singers. That's the other thing I love about the Appalachian style of singing, you know, where it's like, that kind of reminds me actually of some of the traveler styles of singing where it's pure, it's all about projection. And I love the thing that they kind of do where it almost sounds like it's a hiccup at the start. I can't do it. You know what I mean? Where it kind of like they hiccup into the note and then it's just like this big laser beam. Like some of the there's a woman who she's about the same age as me, I think, but if you haven't heard her, you should definitely listen to her. Her name's Elizabeth Leprell.
Oh, I've heard of her.
And she's a fantastic singer, like fantastic, and all like beautiful Appalachian versions of all the ballads. And she's from a place called Rural Retreat in Virginia, I think.
Right.
And I met her because she came over to Ireland to be involved in singing this in a show and singing festival that's on in Donegal. But I just was absolutely floored by her voice, you know, it's just incredible. That was definitely part of igniting my my obsession with Appalachian versions and singing, you know, which is ongoing, to be honest. Like even on like one of the albums on, we just made an album last year, and one of the songs on it is a Gene Ritchie version, you know.
Oh, lovely.
I think the singers I've gotten the most amount of versions from is Gene Ritchie and you. I sing, I think, three versions of songs that I directly got from recordings of you. And one of them is the first song I ever heard. It's the first time I ever heard you. And I just played it on repeat as soon as I heard it. Was the version of Bonnie Boy that you did with your sister.
Yes.
I love the song. I love the, is it a banjo that's playing at the start?
Yes. No, yes, it is. It was my 5-string banjo.
And that's you playing it.
It's me playing it, yes.
It's such beautiful banjo playing as well. It's so, I just absolutely adored it. And there's another song you sing about a cherry tree and Jesus that has really
sung. A cherry tree carol, yes.
Yeah. And it's just, I just love it. I love singing the banjo. And then but your sister, I think she's playing like a small organ and maybe a cello.
It's a flute organ.
Wow.
Otherwise you'd have to have a little boy with you pumping away at the bellows.
Oh, really? So someone has to pump the bellows and somebody else plays the organ?
Originally, yes. Back in the 17th century.
Well, I don't think I've ever even seen one of those in real life.
It's very pretty.
Well, it explains, because I've always wondered, I'm like, what is that sound? It kind of almost sounds like a recorder, but it's not a recorder.
To sing against that, can you imagine? It was just bliss. And Dolly's arrangements were so lovely as well to sing with, you know. I always knew when to come in and she'd write a new arrangement. I always knew when to start. And
yeah,
we were just so close to sisters anyway.
Did you find it easy because you were sisters to just gel? Yeah.
Yes. We were very close, and it was wonderful working with her.
I absolutely adore the work you did with her. It's a big influence on how I think about arranging, actually.
That's lovely.
I really love it. And whenever I recommend you to someone, I always say, first of all, check out with her sister, Dolly, because I just love it, you know. And I think it's such an unusual approach to arranging. It doesn't sound like anything else from that era. It sounds like its own genre, basically.
I have to agree with that. She loved songs as much as I did and understood them as well. You know, it's a question of understanding the music. And again, I say where it comes from.
Yeah, but it suits the songs as well. It's like, I think Bonnie Boy sounds like it's underwater or something. It sounds like an underwater world or, you know, in space or something.
That's a first.
Yeah, that's just what, I don't know, the imagery that comes to me when I listen to it. But yeah, I yeah, I just wanted to tell you how much I love your albums with her.
Thank you.
I don't want to stray into just fangirling you. I definitely wanted to talk to you about Appalachia, and I wanted to talk to you about your sister, and I wanted to talk to you about Davy Graham. So I think I've hit probably the major points for me. Is there anything you'd like to talk about?
No, all I want to say to you, Rady, all that's left to say is that you have one of the great voices. You are great voice. And it's wonderful. Wonderful that you exist.
Oh, you're going to make me cry.
Yeah, I'm crying myself. Thank you.
I can't describe what it feels like to have someone who's influenced me as much as you have, to actually, the fact that you even have heard my singing, never mind like it, feels like a very strange kind of circle.
Then, darling, what you do is you make it yours as well, you know, then becomes you, and you get out for us in this fabulous form. Thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. Honest to God, I've gotten so much from your music. You know, I really have. I just want to say thanks, you know.
Me too. Thank you, Rady. Lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, same. I hope I'll meet you in real life. Please come up say hello next time.
I'll battle my way through the
crowd. We'll get rid of the crowd.
Lots of love, and love to the chaps in the band as well.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Talkhouse podcast, and thanks to Shirley Collins and Rady Pete for chatting. If you liked what you heard, please follow Talkhouse on your favorite podcasting platform and check out all the goodness at talkhouse.com. This episode was produced by Myron Kaplan, and the Talkhouse theme is composed and performed by The Range. See you next time.